Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects. It's interesting, you know, listening to Louis Armstrong's work with that band from 24. I think for me, it's like, this is a fellow that faced unfair bigotry pressure. There's no such thing as fair bigotry, but. And he prevailed. A little black kid from New Orleans, taken in by a Jewish family when he was working on the street. You know, this is a little kid. He was about 6 or 7 years old. He was raised, and which side of that equation strikes you as uncommon? The persecution of Jewish people, or the persecution of black people, or the state of America. It's the point is you could dwell on that, or you could appreciate what this fellow was able to do. He was inspiring, and he did it by himself, you could say, couldn't you? But I think what I want to take away from this morning is that we have a complicated history. It depends really on how realistic we are, how truthful we can be, and why. Why? There are times when things heal and we recognize that and move on. There are times when we can resolve and understand what's happened to us, and other times where we need to ponder that a great long time. We need the patience to do that without rashly making assumptions, because usually, as you know, when we are rash, we often make mistakes that we regret later, or sooner or later. This look at the world and expect that you're going to filter out the positives, that you are going to respond to the positives, whatever they might be. And you can decide that that's something that you can do and maintain a realistic understanding of what's going on around you. How is that different than, assuming that you are, let's say you are a stoic or a skeptic or, you know, all right. So if you accept that, then do you also look at the benefits of it all? Or is it, and the downside of that, downside of casting yourself into a particular lane and then needing to negotiate life in order to stay in that lane? I find that kind of odd. Don't you notice that most of us seem to be conglomerates. We seem to emphasize certain aspects of our character in different ways at different times, according to the situation that we're facing. Overall, we would want to be, I think we understand, if I asked you, how do you come to terms with being a law-abiding citizen? How do you do that? There's a, like a, I don't think it becomes a conscious effort every single day in a way. It's just there, knowing what is expected of us. No, I'm not talking about somebody. I'm not talking about I'm talking more about the influence of this structure and understanding that if we can work collaboratively, we need some rules to help coordinate, some guidelines to help us coordinate. And the more we can do that, the smoother our lives can be, the more predictability we have. And that's a good thing in a world where there's a lot that we can't predict. And thinking in the exchange, is it worthwhile? Well, a sensible or thoughtful person will say, yeah, we'll keep an eye on these processes. We'll hold the systems accountable just as we would ourselves. We are accountable. We need some degree of accountability, but we'll go about our business with accepting these rules will draw us together. And that doesn't mean that we don't have differences of opinion. Oh, my goodness. There's no, as the old Greeks would say, there's no account for taste. Don't even bother arguing about it. Taste is what it is. We set about attempting. And we set about to educate our children, to educate ourselves as well, knowing that education and understanding have something in common. We're not too sure what that connection is often. And I'm not going to detract from those who feel that all education should be geared to income. Having or being able to provide is becoming more and more problematic for for hundreds of thousands of people. We see some of the largest migrations of humanity happening on Earth now. And this isn't science fiction, and nor does it need to be. The climate is going to be coming, or is already, more severe. And that means changes in growth patterns, and that means changes in what we can grow, when we can grow, how much we can grow, how we can access it, as well as the wildlife. They have a pretty careful relationship with nature. They know that the little bird flies to this spot at this time of year because the seeds are on the plants, the seeds they need to eat. We throw off that timing a little bit. They arrive and there's nothing to eat, and not such a good outcome, is it? So I'm not here to talk about the potential for all of that. We know that. We can talk about, in its proper place, we can talk about the effects of mass extinction and things like that if you want. But do you think, to keep a focus on the positives, what is happening? How do you have a positive outlook on something that's an existential crisis? Well, there is a way. The idea of coming together to salvage what we can, to do what we can, knowing that our sacrifice is being appreciated, is something still in our future, isn't it? That collective sense. I think largely it's not because we are terrible creatures. It's just that it hasn't been necessarily articulated in a way that's been shared, that's hit the so-called airwaves, the media. It hasn't become viral. It's been said and thought. If I was to say, well, we know this coming together will produce some wonderful and beautiful things. Well, we could say that it's a comforting kind of a platitude. But what if it's true? What if it is the better option? What if it is the better option that we need, that we can use? that, and what does that do for in a dog eat dog, everyone for themselves kind of existence? Well, we don't entirely live that way. We don't entirely live that way. We live for the goodwill of and respect of people that we love and care about, and that love and care about us. We fit into community. We attempt in our own way to be either, and nobody's intruding in your privacy. If you have that tendency, as I do, particularly in my later age, it's not that I'm troubled by it. It's that it's quite comfortable, and I enjoy. It's like you, when you learn to enjoy your privacy and enjoy and indulge what you can do in your own with your own time. It is a luxury, and how you arrive there. Let's talk about the person whose entire life has been changed because of some health problem. Yeah, right. That happens. And the person is looking at it, normally looking at the loss. I can't do those things anymore. My pattern, my routine has changed incredibly. And I don't see any change, any upswing coming in the future. Now, that's not too unusual, is it? We're diagnosed. We don't just walk around and fall over from some illness anymore. We can, where I am, have the advantage of having a diagnosis. Now, I'm not so sure I want to be told about my genetic propensities for certain illnesses. I'm not so sure I want to live with that. But then again, I like to know if something's going on, what's causing it, and if it's a symptom of something else, what can be done about that symptom. Similarly, when we have symptoms of this sense of malaise, what do we do? Do I put my head in the sand and pretend that it doesn't exist? Good luck with that. I think that's a noble, you know, everybody should have that thought. Can I pretend that this doesn't exist and just make it go away? Or do I have enough influence or enough of a sense of entitlement that I will try that? I will declare that, you know, as we see around us today, the earth is flat. And it's flat because I say it's flat, and I will justify. So we have rational solutions being offered to irrational thinking. And I'm not, so there's a dilemma, not for today, but if you and I can sit over a nice glass of wine and relax together, perhaps we can talk about that. Here, relatable masonry. It isn't about, I think, there's so much conjecture out there around us. But I notice that the struggle of some men, and if we're looking at the advance of masonry, I think we can't ignore the exploration of metaphysics and inner awareness, the consciousness of a man, awareness of himself in situation, in relation to people in his immediate family, as well as people in the broader sphere, his work, his educational background, his friends, his neighbors, his community, his nation. We do have that those connections as we learn to relate to them. Hmm? And recently, we've had, we are a monarchy, a constitutional monarchy, where I am, and with the coronation of a new monarch, it's raised questions about the reasoning. Why is this happening? Is it acceptable? So we're going through that way in, weighing the effects and the reasons. And to be truthful, we're looking at the benefits, whatever they might be. I don't think it's reasonable just to let the figure dominate our thinking. I don't think so. Because there are times when we collectively just want something. Yes, there is a more efficient way of doing it, but we like it this way, and we are collectively willing to pay the price. And I think that coming together happens. Where I am, it's amazing because we're in the second largest landmass nation in the world, and the people are different, and we're spread out all over the place, and the country's not highly populated. So attitudes vary, and to impose, and yet there is a sense of culture here, and it's come through as much through antagonisms as it has through foresight. Now, remember, where I am, I think it's very, very hard to just wallow in despair, because we can look around at despots and what they're doing with the pettiness of leadership, and we can simply say this too will pass, because that's true. That's true. Now, what can we do in the meantime? We can go about our business without letting the burden, somebody else's burden, become our burden. We can do that. We can, I may not be able to understand the totality. When you begin, it just boggles my mind when I begin to think about the complexity of changing our world so that our environment becomes the priority over economics. Frankly, I can understand the idea, but I have no idea how, except in increments. Now, some nations, I'll be honest with you, if I was in Scandinavia, if I was in Denmark, I would have a sense, I think, or New Zealand, have a sense that the nation being an advocate for the people, the safety and well-being of the people, that they would take some steps before the other nations. And some other nations would dig in and say, we have developed these whole systems where people are dependent on these economic streams and they must continue. And then we have other people who are living on a dollar a day or less saying, we will do anything in order to achieve that. Because for us, that is safety, that's security, doesn't matter. Environment, doesn't matter when you're hungry, when your babies are starving. The environment, nope, cutting down the last tree and so it warms your family at night. The environment doesn't matter when people are that desperate. And that's happening, and that's real understanding. And it puts, I think, a responsibility on those nations that have advantage, where we have a greater sense of food security right now, we have a greater sense of safety, and we know that there's a price to pay for that sense of safety. It's not just everybody going rogue and doing everything and having, you know, you have rights. Well, we self-actualize up to a point. We don't drive our bicycles on the sidewalk because that's where people walk. We don't just all collide at intersections because we learn to take turns. Or this beautiful Europe. Europeans have been hiding this from North Americans until just recently. These things, this is magic called roundabouts. Oh, my. You know the simplicity that I'm talking about. Yeah. Oh, this is new. The simplicity of it. And the reaction. I'm not sure I like this. What is this? I'm not sure I can navigate it. Yeah, well, it doesn't take that long, does it? Still, we get people going the wrong way. Yeah, happens here. but not so much, not so much. Now we have ways of communicating. So if we have a good idea and you have a need over there, you know, borrow the good idea. Make it, if it works for us, you know, don't have to trust us. Don't, you can have a hate on for us, but look at the idea, look at what we're doing and see if it works for you. Well, you know, if I look at that, it's not the, I can't really line up politicians behind me to validate any of this. I need to line up scientists. I need physicists and geologists and chemists. And I need philosophers, and I need entrepreneurs. I need people that are capable of building and are capable of negotiating and saying, look, we can have our differences, but everybody seems to thrive if there's peace. Can we talk about that? And it's being triggered everywhere at different times. Everywhere we've had these conversations at different points. Some never get too far away from them. They're always at that point of contention. So we're not new. The world, we haven't invented slavery. We haven't invented apartheid. It is part of the human condition. However, we rail against it. We rail against it. Now, there is the interpretation. We need the politics. That's a level of communication that's absolutely necessary. Are we able to influence that? Yeah. But is it simple? It is in one way, and then another way it isn't. It's as simple as our exercise of the ballot, our participation, our holding the feet of a few people to the cold, to accountability. And we have systems. You know, if you pull a fast one, it's hard to get away with the things these days. And more, even if you're quite wealthy and powerful, you're suspect. We aren't impressed so much with the military power. Now we're looking at the power behind the power. All of which, for us, comes around to why we're together and what we need. If you're fortunate enough to appreciate, I don't know if it's always intelligence. I don't know that, because if you oppressed me, I might not be sure what intelligence is. I know when it's not there, but if you pressed me to tell you what it is or to narrowly define it, I would have a harder time to do that. There are verbal learners, and there are visual learners. And so people learn in different ways and different motivations. We know that a lot of people, there's a desperation. Families will risk their safety to get in small boats to go across waters that they ought not to, trying to get to a place of safety. Trying to get to a place where they can live and set up their family. Now, you know that they'll bring. That means that we're seeing, in a way, I think it's like, you know, the Habsburg Empire, you know, where there's lots of trade going on and cross fertilization of ideas and businesses has these hubs happening around the world. Well, it's as if that's happening all over the place. We may not be living in Amsterdam, but we have a lot of people going through our streets today. Our streets are digital as well as literal. And as a result, ideas are being exchanged. Now, have we eradicated despotism? No. but we know where it is, and we are tracking it, and we are. It becomes an. We do what we can to encourage safety. People that have been getting away with things and governments that have been getting away with things are no longer able to guarantee their safety. There is an accountability, and it seems that good and decent people aren't able or willing to let go. They are calling out and acknowledging that there's a lot of really responsible people around, and we can make these adjustments. The people coming to new countries adjust to the new situation, just as they always have immigrants. There was a time when a certain group of immigrants coming to North America were given instructions about how to fit in. And no need to mention this group. They're very, very gifted group of people. But they would give out a little pamphlet to newcomers, how to talk, what's expected, sort of some of the customs. Even if you wanted to fit in, look at changing your name. Now, I know that's scandalous today, but there was a time when it wasn't so scandalous that it was important to fit in. You know. You fill in the blanks. This is a good show today, I think. We're talking about it's not the relativity, the capacity to relate matters to you. And the sonnet today. I love this. I'm a fan of Victorian sonnets. But William Shakespeare, I don't think he's Victorian. Sit back, relax. Thank you for tuning in, people from all over the world. We have listeners from Japan and New Zealand and Greece and Pakistan and Russia. I'm so pleased that you've agreed to hang in there with us. Brazil, in South America, we've had listeners there for the longest period of time. Of course, the United States, with its multiplex of Masonic functions going on. But Zambia and South Sudan, that and Ethiopia, I can't quite understand how, but welcome. This is wonderful that you're sitting in with us, and sit back and enjoy for whatever time you can. This is Stan Getz. Even back then, my goodness, Herbie Hancock was involved in, rearranging that tune of Stan Getz. Beautiful material. Just beautiful. If it matters, I'd like you to reflect on this just for a second. Freemasonry, Freemasonry has a magic about it. It makes us hear things that aren't necessarily popular. More like tuning in independent music, stuff without the corporate stamp. It's fair that when we underestimate an aspect of Masonry, we bring to our lodge for discussion. Where that breaks down because passions and egotism have not been tamed, the need for conversing to test our ideas does not stop. I find it tedious to listen to them. They don't contribute. They don't listen. They aren't much alike and tedious as hell. They may have brilliant ideas, but can't overcome the frailty of their own beliefs. Either that, or they don't know that trust and what trust and equality actually feel like. Our lodges are where separations are found. Panning for a place or goal does that. We search among the pebbles for nuggets of value. Is it so hard to accept that culture has a bearing on the way we conduct ourselves as boys, as men, as elders? We are never too far away from the effects of culture within cultures. We enter into a culture that has distinct values and distinct language, concepts of universality, which values learning and questioning, where growth continues as long as we live. Better for us to understand finding balance comes from understanding our priorities. It is inconceivable to think a lodge would not be able to delight our senses every time we gather. Sensible men understand masonry from the first moment. Some get it. Some continue on with profane world influence, no worse off, but no better. For those times when we aren't sure of the appropriate solution, we have tools that let us make those calculations. We don't have a list of answers. We have tools to understand. Masonic learning is a step, as is logos. When in doubt, we have covered that with a neurotic Aude Vide Tace mnemonic. Sorry, not neurotic. Mnemonic Aude Vide Tace. When in doubt. Aude, listen. Vide, watch. In silence, Tace. Our sense of virtue, the alleged key to a better life, outline character traits mankind calls refinement. Trust your senses. Trust masonry. But make that determination yourself, brethren. Yeah, a little gift from Dexter Gordon from 1962. Well worth it. Sonny Clark, Butch Warren, Billy Higgins, well worth the effort. That's from their album. Oh, sweet. I did on Blue Note. Yeah. Another Blue Note, hey? This is from one of a program favorites, one of the world favorites. William Shakespeare. Yep. He was born in 1564, and we still think about him today. He's regarded as the greatest writer in the English language. And we may have detractors, but his name starts the conversation. As in terms of the development of Masonic reasoning, he died in 1616, but masonry was already, the aspects of it were already developed in the 16th century before that. Now, It depends, too, on whether we're talking about structure or form or function. The function of masonry was being practiced. The form of masonry, as I know it, or as you know it, does that define masonry? And if it does, then the masonry back in that day was not of this condition. Hmm. I think he started off fairly humble. His father made gloves for a living. He had seven siblings. When he was 18, he married an older woman who happened to be pregnant. He had three kids. Then they moved the family to London, where he took jobs acting as well as writing. That's William. The sonnet that I prepared for today is the Sonnet 138. This is a very frank understanding of a man's relationship with a mistress. Do we run to the windows and shriek about that, or do we sit back and reflect? It represents, and I'm lifting these from student notes you can find on the internet. And I like that because it gives us a bit of background for offered to critical thinkers, students. Yeah? The 138 sonnet presents a candid psychological study of the mystery of the mistress that reveals many of her hypocrisies. Certainly, she's still very much the poet's mistress, but the poet is under no illusions about her character. For instance, when my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her, though I know she lies. He accepts without protest her false-speaking tongue and expects nothing better of her. Cynically, he too deceives and is comforted by knowing that he is no longer fooled by the woman's charade of fidelity to him, nor she by how young and simple-minded he presents himself to be. In a relationship without affection or trust, the two lovers agree to a relationship based on mutual deception. Both agree never to voice the truth about how much their relationship is built on never spoken truths. But wherever she says she not, she is unjust. And wherever say not I, that I am old. Note that the sentence structure in these two lines is identical. Similar to how both the poet and the woman identically feign lying when each other knows the other person knows the truth. The main theme of the concluding two lines is lust. But it is treated with a wry humor. The poet is content to support the woman's lies because he is flattered that she thinks him young, even though he knows that she is well aware just how old he is. On the other hand, he does not challenge her pledges of faithfulness, even though she knows that he is aware of her infidelity. Neither is disposed to unveil the other's defects. Ultimately, the poet and the woman remain together for two reasons. The first being their sexual relationship. The second, that they are obviously comfortable with each other's lying. Both of these reasons are indicated by the pun on the word lie, meaning to have sex with or to deceive. Therefore, I lie with her and she with me. And in our faults, but lies we flattered be. Whew. Tell me if you find that. When my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her, though I know she lies. That she might think me some untutored youth, unlearned in the world's false subtleties, thus vainly thinking that she thinks me young, although she knows my days are past the best. Simply, I credit her false-speaking tongue. On both sides, thus is simple truth suppressed. But wherefore says she, not she, is unjust. And wherefore say not I that I am old? Oh, love's best habit is in seeming trust. And age and love loves not to have years told. Therefore I lie with her and she with me. And in our faults, by lies, we flattered be. I hope that time goes by. Fans of Casablanca will love me for that. Probably the best film ever made. Yeah. Speaking today, we're History Corner here. Speaking, this part is about, takes us back to 1773 period. Yeah, you know, we've been through talking about, you know, passions and egotism and all the things that inhibit the growth of dialogue. Inhibit, but don't stop it, because it's happening in other places. Here we have a reference right off the top of a Rousseauian version of masonry. And just to explain for listeners that aren't, that don't have that reference at the at their fingertips, Jean-Jacques Rousseau is a philosopher, French philosopher, of course, who's famous for reconceiving the social contract, being a compact between the individual and the collective general will, the common good. Now, he explains, there's some parts of this that I think do relate to us and make us, help us understand this. In his thinking, there are three main points. The first state, there's three stages. The state of nature, where man is free and independent. Society, in which a man is oppressed and dependent on others. State under the social contract, in which, ironically, man becomes free through obligation. Now, that latter part, this is, might be a bit heady for us, but that latter part does help us address, help raise questions about the notion of compliance and the point, the liberation of compliance. The Rousseauian, then, version of Freemasonry possessed a particular coherence. Rousseau's condemnation of French society, remember, this is before the Revolution, close to it, but before it, his condemnation of French society resonated with Masonic utopianism. You know, that we could all live together. His emphasis on the heart as the key to human progress appealed to the Masonic love of ceremony and fraternal affection. It also humanized the Enlightenment for men who might strive to be reasonable, but knew that they were driven by feelings and emotion. Now they could form a just idea of Freemasons, who are to be regarded as a society of symbolic philosophies, are constantly wise, cultivating the pleasures of society and the sweetness of friendship. The general character of these philosophies is one of simplicity, moderation, sweetness, and tranquility. We may find it nothing short of extraordinary that men wedded to socializing and civility, some of it quite lavish and formal, could embrace Rousseau's call to return to the simplicity of nature. But the lodges had always been described as not quite of this world, separate, better, enriching. By the 1770s, some brothers could imagine that Rousseau had summed up what they had always been searching for in Masonic laws and practices. Indeed, Rousseau received personal encouragement from two leaders of Dutch Freemasonry, the brothers William and Charles Bentinck. They invited him to their home, and throughout his life, Charles Bentinck thought that Rousseau had expressed the essence of Christianity, which is not dogmas, but morality. In the late 1760s, Amsterdam Freemasons were told by their orator about the main reason why Freemasonry was so well received by enlightened men. It restored men to their natural state. We may call it a Rousseauian condition, a state of transparency without disguise. So by implication, we're talking about an emphasis on freedom and the return to the natural state of mankind, you know, the noble savage kind of thinking, unfettered by modernity. Is that, do we aspire to that? The claim here is that is through historic reference and a philosophical backstop that Masonry has the capacity, offers the capacity to enlighten men. And I tend to think that I have been calling them true Masons, and I tend to think that this is more apt description. Enlightened men will find freedom within the order. Now, are you looking for the manual on that? You know, the five easy steps to enlightenment? No. Of course not. Well, this wraps up the show for another week. Thank you very much for tuning in. I hope it's been productive for you, interesting that we've contributed in some small way to another conversation, to our next conversation. What's coming up in our review of this part of history, I think is going to give us a bit of a framework. And it really does begin with more philosoph. Then the claim here that we're going to be talking about is being more philosoph than those who tediously parade and sterilely seek to display the sublime maxims of the philosophies. The Masons search modestly to put them into practice. So we have the undercurrent. We have the philosoph, and then we have those who will parade. And as the historian writes here, sterilely seek to display the sublime maxims, display them without understanding them. Yeah. I don't think that this is out of context, but I think we need to get over this. I really do. I'd like to just take a deep breath and move on. Wouldn't you? I think, but this conversation is ongoing. It's not the conversation I want to put behind. It's the conversation focusing on people that don't relate to Masonry. And I think, well, there's a lot of people in the world that don't relate to Masonry. I don't know if I can do anything about their capacity, and I don't. I can only experience Masonry as I do and share it with you who are enjoying Masonry as well. And then we have the conversation, like-minded. I like to think in hindsight that somebody might call us enlightened, but that's not for me to say. It's an absolute pleasure. I hope you will continue to commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, and do it deliberately. It's not just words that bounce off you. You don't have to pay any attention to it. I like to ask you to actually implement it. If you're practiced at it, it will be a way of thinking, automatic. But if you're not, then practice it deliberately. Practice it with purpose. But practice it, because there's a joy that comes. And I can't teach you that, and I wouldn't dangle that. It's not a carrot carrot, a reason for you, you need to find that if you feel that you deserve that. If you don't, well, there's, the world's a big place. But as a Mason, as a brother and part of this order, it is the point that self-awareness. I'll see you again real soon. Thanks for tuning in.